when you're having not as good a day, or when things have been a little more difficult, these thoughts can creep in of like, oh, like, maybe this isn't a real relationship and I am more at risk of losing this than someone else in a more intertwined relationship, in a more entangled relationship, right? Who has more shared finances, who owns a house together or whatever it is. But like, maybe they're right. Maybe they are more secure than I am, and I am really going to end up alone, like all of my friends or my family keep worrying
that I am.
That's going to happen to me.
If you're happy with the same old ways of dating,
if you enjoy sucking at communication,
and you have no desire to improve your romantic life, then our podcast might not be for you.
But if you want some out-of-the-box ideas to deepen your current relationships,
broaden your sexual horizons,
develop a better understanding of yourself,
or learn more about non-monogamy,
then you've come to the right place. I'm Jace.
I'm Emily.
And I'm Dedeker.
And this is the Multiamory Podcast.
On this episode of the Multiamory Podcast, we're talking about hangovers. All right, not the hangover that you get after drinking all night, but the residual thoughts and assumptions and habits and things that are instilled in us from a very early age by our movies and our books and our music. In other words, the outdated and unhealthy models that we're given for how relationships are supposed to look.
Yeah, so we thought that we would talk about this today. There was a thread in our private Patreon discussion group specifically about what people are referring to as the monogamy hangover. And we didn't quite want to just focus on that particular term for a couple of reasons. One of them, like I immediately have a little bit of pushback on that term because I'm like, oh, I don't know how I feel about treating monogamy like it's this toxic,
awful,
poisonous
thing.
Yeah, gives you this awful hangover and it's super painful and it's like you just got to get it out of your system as soon as possible. I'm sure people definitely can experience it that way. I've definitely experienced it that way to a certain degree, but I don't want it to be just like this black and white, like monogamy is the bad thing that you got to detox from yourself.
Yeah, yeah. I think, I mean, using the term hangover for it is honestly a little bit weird because, you know, a hangover, it's like, well, I did this thing the night before too much. Like I did something to excess. And now the next day, it doesn't mean I'm not going to do that thing again.
Too much monogamy the night before.
Right. Like it's just a little weird. I guess I get it.
Like, I still like with the Japanese definition of a hangover. What did you say? It's like the second day drunk.
Yeah, the word is futsukayoi, which literally translates to second day drunk, which is kind of a misnomer. I think it makes a hangover sound more exciting and fun than it actually is in reality. You're like, ooh, second day of being drunk, great.
No, I've had some really wicked hangovers, so let's not do that again.
Haven't we all?
Right. Yeah. So we're not calling it the monogamy hangover on this episode.
Also because Jace discovered that term's actually trademarked in the UK.
That's amazing.
Believe it or not.
Yeah, so this company trademarked the term monogamy hangover, and they have, like, you know, you can pay to do workshops or like take their classes and stuff about it.
So it is specifically like non-monogamy focused workshops and stuff?
Yeah, so from what I could gather, the company itself is not, they're not specifically like only non-monogamy focused. But they're like poly-friendly, non-monogamy-friendly. Like that's kind of part of it. But it's sort of a company that does relationship coaching and therapeutic stuff and like workshops and those sorts of things. Anyway, so yeah, there's like technically a couple companies that jointly own this trademark.
I guess
in the UK. So we actually, because we're in the US, we could have titled our episode that. But I'm also like, well, that's kind of like a specific thing that someone is selling. And whether it's good or not, I don't know. Like whether it's a helpful workshop, I don't know.
I guess the lesson is just like, especially if you're in the UK, don't start making some t-shirts and selling them that say monogamy hangover on it. I don't know why you would, but just, you know, don't do that because trademark laws.
Well, right. Okay, when we're talking about this at all, when we're talking about something that is deemed the monogamy hangover, or when we're talking about what we want to delve into in this episode, what does that entail exactly?
Right. Well, I think one thing that we do want to differentiate here is that we're not just talking about stuff that's like leftovers of monogamy after you've decided not to be monogamous, but we're more talking about it generally as like, if you've made this conscious decision to change the way you approach relationships and think about relationships, whether that's in a monogamous way or a polyamorous way or something else,
mm-hmm.
but you have made this conscious decision to like, I'm going to step away from what society teaches me is normal, or like what's kind of the standard thing of like what you should aspire to, what you should want, that when you step away from that, you can be like, yeah, I believe these different things. And on a good day, that is true.
Mm-hmm.
But this is about what happens, like, if things are a little bit difficult, or if you're doubting yourself one day, or you're just not feeling as on top of the world that day, these sort of like lingering kind of like ghosts that come to haunt you.
What if we called it
the ghosts of monogamy past?
Yes. Well, what if we zoomed out a bit and made mm-hmm. a little bit more expansive, and it was more about like a normativity hangover? Because when we're talking about this, I realize this can apply to many other arenas of one's life, not just relationships, you know, like, for instance, what shows up in my life, like some kind of like economic normativity hangover of like
your life
I have to be making this much money, I should be aspiring to own these particular kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
I should be aiming for this particular type of career.
You should own a house.
I should be productive at all hours of the day, and my worth is measured by my productivity. So there's definitely that kind of hangover where it's like, logically, I'm like, I know that's not true. I feel really satisfied in my life. I feel like the things I'm pursuing are worthwhile. But those kind of old feelings, like, that ghost of normativity past, I think, can still come up and kind of ruin your day occasionally.
I think that for me that shows up in what I will now coin the term jobonormativity.
All right. Just pick it up and run with it.
Just go with it. Jobonormativity, which is this idea that you should want to have kind of a normal full-time job for a company that you're trying to move up in within an industry or whatever,
climbing
right?
That corporate ladder.
Yeah, in whatever your industry is. And I know that for me, my aspiration is to move away from that. And I have been gradually moving away from that. But people will look at me and go, oh, I worry about you, that eventually you're going to end up old with like nothing saved up and you're going to be living on the streets, basically. They didn't say it quite like that, but right, that sort of thing. Or that I don't own a house or whatever, like Dedeker said. And that's not to say that I won't, but those aren't like, I don't have quite those same aspirations. And when I'm feeling down, I will doubt that myself, because it's like, well, everyone else thinks this, like, what if they're right? Like, maybe I'm the one who's wrong here.
Do you think that all of those things are kind of a product of our specific society, like here in America? Because I know we may have listeners out there who come from different places that may have a whole different set of expectations, or not exactly the ones where we're like in this super competitive culture with one another and super like we need to live up to the American dream that we were promised, you know?
Well, I don't know. My theory is I think a lot of these things are somewhat inherent to Western culture. And because Western culture has been so prolific and we'll just say colonial, you know, that bleeds into a lot of other cultures that maybe didn't hold values that were that similar, I think. We could really get into the specifics, but I think that's just like a whole, that's turning things into a whole other topic. But I think there are parts of it that are uniquely American, but I also think a lot of it is just kind of broadly Western, I would think.
Yeah.
And I would bet that people
maybe
listening in other...
Western capitalist. We want
right.
to get
yeah,
more specific.
Capitalism, I think, definitely adds to that equation hugely.
I think that patriarchy is also a part of it.
Oh, for sure.
So,
just all the good things.
All the good things, yeah. but I think that like there may be subtle like shades are slightly different in other countries, but I feel like at least most countries where people would be listening to this podcast will at least be able to relate to the majority of the stuff here. Cause I feel like Dedeker said, that culture has so colonialized the world and impacted the world through movies and literature and TV and, you know, music and entertainment. And then also just in those things like capitalism and patriarchy and, you know,
yeah, it's very prevalent.
Well, so, but to bring it back in, if our focus for today is kind of like the relationship normativity hangover, let's say.
I'm going to stop. The ghosts of normativity past. I really like that. That was good.
Okay. The ghosts of relationship normativity past. TM, 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 TM. That's going to be what we trademark and we'll put on our t-shirts. And that's what we'll title our workshops.
Don't you put that on
workshops.
A t-shirt. Yeah.
So let's start getting into the specifics of what sort of relationship-based or sex-based lingering beliefs do a lot of us still carry? And again, this isn't specifically like those of us who are just choosing non-monogamy, but I mean pretty much like everyone who's trying their hand at this whole adult relationship thing. What are some particular things?
I have one. The idea that like you need to search for your one true love, or just your one, the one, or your soulmate. All of those things that we've seen in like books or fairy tales or whatever. I mean, I was hanging out with a friend the other day and she's like, well, you know, I haven't found the one yet. And I don't know if I can have kids because I haven't found the one yet. And I'm 32 years old. So by the time I find the one and then marry him and have kids, I'm going to be like 40. And I'm like, oh, okay.
It's just like a lot of assumptions based on like what you have to do in order to have the life you want.
Totally. Yeah. Just that's like the thing that we aspire to. We talked about this a bit last week and in the relationship goals, but I think that, that's like a personal goal that a lot of people have in the back of their head always.
It's like finding the one.
I'm looking for the one.
Yeah.
Which is fine, but also maybe not always productive.
Well, I feel so torn by it because I don't know, y'all. I'm sorry.
I
feel like I divested myself of any belief in soulmates in the one like a long time ago. Like honestly, even before I was on the non-monogamy train, I was already kind of like
non-mog train.
That non-mog train, and I was already kind of like, I don't know about this because it's like, well, statistically, like, there's how many people in the world, and why is it that everyone's one happens to be like, oh, you know, they happen
there
to.
They are.
There they are.
They're right in front of me.
They
wow.
were just, you know, happen to be the same like
destiny,
the same like skin color and socioeconomic bracket. And we just happen to, you know, be interested in the same kind of job, and they're the one, you know. And so I was kind of like, well, I don't know about that. For me, because I was raised in a Christian home, it was much more wrapped up in this idea of like God has this plan for you. God has someone picked out for you, and they're, you know, God's going to send this man, this perfect man, this man who's going to be your husband to you. And that's why it's, you know, worth waiting to have sex until you get married. And that's why it's worth not dating around, because, you know, you got to trust that God's going to send this stuff to you. And so for me, it was a little bit less of this mystical thing and more of like, there's a higher power who is looking for your
preordained.
It's kind of like it's preordained.
Yeah. See, that's something that I never grew up with. So just all
of
that,
like, did you get any kind of soulmate? Soulmate training?
Yes. When I was my very first boyfriend in high school, who turned out to be a real piece of work and was really, really mean to me and abusive later on. But initially, my mom was like, and I think just because it was going well in a lot of NRE and stuff. And she's like, well, maybe you found your one like already.
What? No.
I know, right?
Yeah. I know. How old were you? Like eight?
15.
You may as well have been eight.
Yeah, I know.
For me,
I was
eight. It feels
eight.
Just as ridiculous as saying to an eight-year-old, maybe you found the one.
No, I hear you. I agree. And I mean, you know, at the time I was like totally wrapped up in the emotion of it all, because what freaking teenager isn't wrapped up in the emotion of literally everything?
Yeah, I was going to say, I would almost trust an eight-year-old's opinion of finding the one more than a teenager because they don't have all these hormones convincing them.
Yeah, I think that that's fair. So it was, but in terms of like the possibility of like, I've heard the term Catholic guilt a lot, or like the guilt involved in like, well, you know, you're giving your flower away to someone every time you sleep with them. I've heard that before, like some sort
of there's all kinds
flower metaphor.
No, there's all kinds
am I
of
wrong?
Terrible metaphors.
That
like,
is, yeah. Yeah,
there's
yeah.
a metaphor of like you're a piece of tape, and every time the tape sticks to something, it's a little less sticky. And
I
then who wants
that.
This? Like,
well, I have never
no,
heard that.
Literally,
what?
I am not exaggerating. There's also the
you
the,
are a piece of tape.
There's the piece of gum one of like. You know, if someone chews up the gum, you don't want to take that gum out of their mouth and then chew it up yourself, especially if it's been chewed by 10 people.
Holy
shit. You know, you don't want to have that gum. There's the you're used a piece of gum one. There was one that I saw where like a bunch of kids, a bunch of kids were stood up at the front of a classroom and like everyone had a cup of water and everyone had a little bag of Doritos and everyone ate a Dorito. And then took a sip of water, swished it out, and spit it back into the cup. And then everyone swapped cups. And everyone was like, okay, take a drink of that cup. You don't want to, do you? Because someone's like swished around and spit in it. Well, that's what happens when you have sex. And to
wait
a certain
minute,
extent,
wait a
I'm
minute,
like,
wait a minute,
well,
wait
yes.
a minute. Were these things that actually occurred in class?
This actually occurred, Emily. It actually occurred.
Emily's mind is melting out
no,
of her ears.
No, I mean,
right
like,
now.
I have to say, like, if. I'm pretty sure if my mother ever like knew any of that would have been going on, she would have like taken me out immediately. Like that is some really, really awful shit to be telling your kid.
For sure.
And just that they were like, that's all that they amount to is a chewed up Dorito in a glass of water.
It also completely negates like anyone's experience of like being raped or assaulted.
Yeah. Are you fucking
you know,
kidding me?
There were a
I'm
lot
sorry.
Of assault victims who like many years later did come forward being like, I remember that piece of tape talk and where it's like, well, I didn't consent to this, but now I'm a used up piece of tape or a chewed up piece of gum and no one's going to want me.
I'm so, so sorry.
Yeah, the whole thing is awful. But I do want to bring us back to the topic.
Yeah,
at
we
hand
don't
here.
Gotta get too
I feel
deep
like
into that.
I feel like we've basically touched on two other topics that I think could be complete episodes on their own. I think I honestly think we could do an entire episode about the one and soulmates and that whole thing.
Yeah.
I think that would actually be really interesting. I was actually just this morning writing some stuff about that. And
I did some research on that in my book about like the origin of the whole one mythos or soulmate mythos. And it's actually only what, like 300, maybe 400 years old? No, not even that old, actually. So it's actually a relatively new concept within our, I don't know, human
right.
Like Renaissance
yeah.
period.
I'm
going to
say
time.
Zeitgeist.
Yeah. And then of course, you know, problems with sort of the religious guilt and some of the ways that that's taught to us when we're younger, whether we're raised Christian or not, like that's still kind of in the culture and is influencing people who are then influencing you. But what I want to bring this back to on this topic is how would these two things, like, can you give examples of how these things would actually show up?
Yes.
Like as this sort of ghost of
I can give you a billion
relationship
I can
normativity
give you
past.
1 billion examples, but we don't
wait,
have
1
time.
Billion. Go.
Okay, one. Number one.
Number sorry, one. I'm not going to say
the way. Okay, the one way that I've definitely seen it show up in my life and in the lives of clients and the lives of many other people is it really makes things fuzzy when someone's trying to leave a bad relationship because I've definitely told myself the story of like, well, this feels crappy, but like maybe this person is the one and like this
and if
is
I miss out on this.
Yes,
then.
And I can't miss out on this. And this is, you know, either it's like God's doing this to test us and to test our love, or it's something along the lines of like, you know, and this is just how it goes. You know, it's like they're the one, and so they're gonna be worth every single battle, they're gonna be worth every single obstacle. So basically I guess I've seen it keep me in some really poor relationships much longer than I should have. I've seen a lot of people go back to really bad relationships because they think like, oh, this person's the one. So that's, I mean, that's how I've definitely seen it manifest in people's lives, including my own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it can also show up as a sense of sort of entitlement to someone else. Because if I feel this strongly about you and I believe you're the one, that mythology doesn't leave an option where you don't also love me.
Mm.
You know, you maybe just don't know it yet. And I feel like that can end up in maybe even the flip side of what Dedeker's talking about, where you like keep going back to a relationship being like, or staying in one. Maybe it's the one is also like feeling like you need to keep someone else in a relationship with you when they're not happy.
Mm.
Because, well, they're the one like,
yeah.
So it's going to work out. Mm. Kind of this just like, I believe it, so therefore it's true.
Mm. obviously the two of you are not particularly religious anymore in any sense of the word. However, I definitely have heard you be like the guilt thing is like shown up at times in various ways, or just like you've been like, huh, like at things because you've had like religious upbringing, like way, way deeply buried in your past kind of thing.
Well, I feel like
I thought that I've heard you talk about that
on the show. You've talked about that too, though, Emily.
No, for sure. Like, I mean, in terms of,
I don't
like,
think it's just religion that gives us that guilt about like, sex or about,
no, I mean, again, like
it.
Our patriarchal culture and the Madonna horror complex and all those things, like it wanting sex or wanting to be sexual or sexual in certain ways or whatever, or, you know, anything other, anything that's not deemed normal, definitely like has a potential for guilt being attached to that. So, yeah.
Gosh, yeah, that's a deep dive to go into. You brought up the Madonna horror complex and connected to religious guilt and just general guilt. I mean, I think that what I definitely feel to a certain extent is pretty American from what I've seen. But again, that's not necessarily scientific. That's just anecdotal based on my experience.
As an American.
Is that sex is just a rife topic to feel guilty, however, whatever way you slice it, you know, whether, and especially if you're a woman, whether it's like you want too much sex or you don't want sex enough or the kind of sex you want isn't okay or you don't want to have the kind of sex that I want. And so that's okay. You know, like, I guess, and I feel like a lot of that is really wrapped up in just a lot of the cultural messages that we receive about sex or making sex like way, way, way important in a relationship where it's like, if we're not quite sexually compatible, that means the entire thing's off.
Yeah.
Or if we're only sexually compatible and then in the rest of our relationship, we just kind of get along as friends, or maybe we're okay just being acquaintances, that's not okay, you know. It's like the whole topic. I think people have many different variations of kind of the old baggage and the old stuff that comes up, but it's often related to sex.
Yeah,
well, I think you touched on one that I've definitely noticed comes up a lot for people and has come up in my own relationships, is that sort of equating love with sex and being like, if you're in love, you must also be wanting to have sex and having sex with
and
each other.
And great at sex too with that person.
Sure, that too. Yeah. So like, if the sex isn't good,
then they must not be the one.
Well, they all look back on themselves. Yeah. Like, they must not be the one, or like, well, we must not be in love anymore. Like this sort of equating of like, our sex life has fallen off, so we must not be as in love as we were, that those things can kind of get conflated with each other.
I guess that also builds into like, if we're not feeling NRE for each other anymore.
Yeah,
then,
that's a good
which
one
is
too.
Like ridiculous. Like,
I feel like I've started to, I don't know, I've picked up more of a cultural narrative around people accepting that it's like those feelings of NRE do fade and they do turn into like more bonding feelings, and that's okay. However, when it comes to sex specifically, I noticed there's still kind of hanging on to this, like, how do we get the sex back to how it was when we were in NRE? You know, and
so
that's,
many things for, and like, for married people written about that specifically.
Yeah. How to make your sex life, you know, you are 20 again or something.
Something like that. Yeah. And just like, I think there's definitely a lot of really wonderful, intentional things that you can do to have your sexual connection with your partner be awesome. And I think that you should be doing those things if both of you are interested in sex. But there's
still,
it's hard to think
that like you're going to be fucking like 2 times a day, like 7 days a week, like you might have been right when you met each other.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Ain't nobody got time for that. Shit.
Well, in this economy.
I mean, maybe, but
I think we acknowledge that. And most people, when you say that, they're like, yeah, of course. But I feel like underneath the surface, a lot of people do feel a certain amount of, I don't know, maybe guilt or disappointment, or like, if I really was with the one, like that wouldn't ever have gone down like that.
I think also related, definitely this idea of, I need to be the best sexual partner my partner's ever had.
Oh, wow.
And oh, my God.
Related to definitely. That, I need to be willing and able to do absolutely everything my partner wants to do in bed. And if I can't, then I risk losing that person.
Gotta be amazing at X, Y, or Z thing.
Yeah. And
super into this as well. And
yeah. No, there's so much. I don't know. It's really sad because I think back on like so much. So many kinds of sex that I had that I didn't really want to have. And I mean, that makes it sound really bad. It's not that it wasn't consensual or that it was forced upon me. It was more of like, because of this narrative,
I want to be the cool girl.
Yeah. If I don't do this thing that my partner's asked me to do, then he's going to be so disappointed that he's going to go find it someone else to do it with.
Totally.
And while now I'm kind of like, great, please do.
You do that. Go on.
I think back then, even when I was getting into my first non-monogamous relationships, I still felt that way.
Well, again, it's like that competitive side also being like, shit, like I'm in a sense like competing against all of my partner's previous partners and all of the potential partners that they may have. And I have to live up to that and step up to that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like in acting school, so many people, they would tear you down, obviously, but then a lot of the teachers would, after tearing you down, be like, you are enough. You are enough. Like, you don't have to try to be anything other than you. You are enough. And that might be, like, kind of ridiculous advice, but I think it is true in these senses, because even if, like, you don't want necessarily the same kind of sexual things that your partner does, you have to understand, like, you as yourself have amazing qualities that your partner is interested in, even if it's not just for your like ridiculous sexual prowess and all the like anal that you want to do with them constantly or whatever.
Sure, whatever. Just whatever
whatever it happens
constant
to be.
Constant anal.
Or a specific type of role play or a
I'm sorry.
Specific whatever.
Or it's group sex or
too.
Whatever.
I just watched Requiem for a Dream, so that last scene is in my head is all that I'm going to say.
Well, instead of talking about Requiem for a Dream, let's talk about that sensation of like not enough or of needing
Never
or of like,
has anyone seen?
No,
no. Damn it. But this idea that I think starts to bleed over, especially when people are exploring non-monogamy, is this idea of you as you are need to be enough, not in the sense of like what you were talking about, Emily, of like, oh, you need to accept yourself because you're enough and you're good and you're whole and you're valid, but more of like, I need to be enough to fulfill every single one of my partner's needs, which is a path well traveled within these circles and these conversations about someone not necessarily being able to fulfill all of your needs. But this is still a very present thing that people feel like they need to live up to, you know?
Yeah, it definitely best comes friend, up. Lover, amazing sexual partner, confidant, mother, father,
personal
everything.
Trainer, nurse,
therapist,
oh
my gosh,
everything.
And it's not that, I mean, when I think about my relationships now, like I think about my partners and each of them have filled that role at some point or another, but they've never been the only person filling that role in my life.
And they've like, probably never done it all at the same time or like,
yes, let's say like the therapist role, for instance. It's like, yeah, I go to Jace a lot. I go to Alex a lot to talk about things and to process things, but I also go to a regular therapist and I also go to like friends and family.
They don't have to fill that job completely.
Yeah.
That's really interesting.
Right. Or like having friends to hold you accountable for things or whatever. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can we talk about marriage?
Marriage.
That blessed arrangement?
Marriage. Who was that? No, that wasn't what's his butt? Wallace Shawn?
No, Wallace Shawn was Vicini.
Oh, yeah.
They're talking about Princess Bride, for those of you who are with question
marks.
Oh,
come on. I'm sure they all haven't seen that show.
There might be a few
people. So there's still obviously this idea, I think, even in the back of one's mind, even if you're not practicing like hierarchy, that if you are married, it still like holds a huge amount of weight in non-monogamous relationships and in monogamous relationships, that like it is the pinnacle of all relationship statuses. Statuses.
Stata? I don't know.
Stratums.
Stati? Stratums, yes.
Yeah,
that's a great point. That again, this applies whether you're monogamous or non-monogamous, but just this idea that it's not real unless it's marriage.
Mm.
And I think what goes along with that too is if you've been married and have been divorced, that you're somehow less than
you're in your second or third marriage. So, right. Or if you're in a relationship for many, many years and you never get married, that like somehow,
right.
It's like, not well, real. It's not really like, what are you doing? You're not really committing, or you're just holding out to see if like something better comes along.
Yeah, I was reading an interesting editorial recently that obviously like our generation of millennials are showing different patterns of marriage than our parents' generation. Namely that fewer of us are getting married. Most of us who do get married are getting married much later in life, you know, kind of post-career or, you know, post-establishing career or whatever. And some people attribute that to, oh yeah, you know, values around marriage are changing. And I do think part of it is that, you know, I do think it helps when you have women who are able to make a living for themselves and not necessarily dependent upon finding a spouse. But other people have pointed out that it's like, it's kind of shifted now, like because of, you know, the economy and job opportunities being so bad combined with freaking weddings being so expensive that now for millennials, marriage has also become kind of a status symbol as well. You know, that it's like you finally get to the point where you're financially stable enough that you can afford the house and you can afford the, you know, having the marriage ceremony and all those things that to, so it's kind of like a milestone. I mean, it's always been considered a milestone, but kind of in this much different way than it was for our parents, I think.
Yeah. I think that, I mean, going along with this, we'll just segue right into the relationship escalator.
Of course.
And that's whether or not it's marriage specifically, but this idea that in order for a relationship to be real or to be serious, it needs to be moving upward on this trajectory toward certain things being, you know, certain things being entwined with each other, or that it has to have these aspects to it, whether those are sex that it has to have, or, you know, certain types of sex, or it has to be living together, it has to be sharing finances. And even if we, like the three of us who, you know, very vocally speak about like, well, it doesn't have to have all those things. I don't have all those in my relationships. Those aren't goals of mine in all of my relationships. There still can be this like, again, like when you're having not as good a day or when things have been a little more difficult, these thoughts can creep in of like, oh, like maybe this isn't a real relationship and I am more at risk of losing this than someone else in a more intertwined relationship, in a more entangled relationship, right? Who has more shared finances, who owns a house together or whatever it is. But like maybe they're right. Maybe they are more secure than I am. And I am really going to end up alone. Like all of my friends or my family keep worrying
that I am.
That's going to happen to me. And that's kind of what we're getting at here with all of these, you know?
Yeah, I've definitely pulled the cohabiting one of first of all, of just assuming like, well, all my romantic relationships need to lead to cohabitation. But I've also pulled the, if I choose to cohabit with this person, it will make the relationship more secure. Which
sometimes that's the opposite.
Well, from my experience, like it kind of does on a surface level at the very least to start. But if it wasn't feeling secure before, like usually that indicates there's some more fundamental issues that are going to follow you even when you choose to start living together, was the painful lessons that I've had to learn over the course of my adult life.
Yeah. I mean, that's actually been, it's not wrong that it will make you more likely to stay together longer by living together is not necessarily wrong. Like there have been studies showing that doing those sorts of things that basically make it harder to break up do make you less likely to break up because of the, like the troubles involved and the barriers to it. Like sort of the sunken cost fallacy is what it's called in business. Right. It's like, well, but I've invested this much and I've become this entwined, so I should stick it out a little bit longer. But all of this, it goes back to maybe something that we didn't even put on our list here, but could belong there, which is that like the marker of a good relationship is simply time. Right. That idea that like, well, it doesn't matter if we're happy or not. What matters is that we last longer.
I mean, to go back to the religion thing, like some people literally say, like, I don't believe in divorce. So even in a loveless marriage, or I'm seriously unhappy and depressed all the time. I've had friends who are religious who say this. Mm-hmm. They're like, I won't divorce my partner because God does not believe in divorce.
Right. Well, I feel like that also gets connected to not even religiously specific ideas around,
parents.
Well, the idea, it's like saying, don't do it's this. Like selfish to advocate for your own happiness in a relationship.
Oh,
it's noble to suffer through a bad relationship. And again, these things get foggy because to a certain extent, like, you know, of course you can't be advocating for only your own happiness in a relationship and not caring about the feelings of others. So there's like a little bit of truth in that. And then also, yes, like you are going to have to deal with things being uncomfortable or there being conflict or, you know, disagreements or, you know, periods of discomfort in your relationship. So there's a little bit of seed of truth to that. But then I think it often gets interpreted as this extreme of, it's if you're unhappy, that's okay because it's worth it to suffer through a bad relationship for the sake of them either being the one or making a relationship work or being able to squeeze an extra 5 years out of your relationship or something like that.
Yeah, I was just reading some stuff earlier from the Gottman Institute earlier today about kind of like how it's normal for relationships over time to go through hardships and difficult things. But what matters in terms of relationships being happy together, like people being happy together, is how they think about those things, not just whether they got through them or not. It's like how they felt about that experience. Mm. Was it like we together overcame this thing and it was good? Or was it like it's still this thing I look back on as like with shame or with a sense of failure or still like resentment about this thing we went through? That it's like, I guess the point I'm trying to make here is just that, like, while things aren't always going to be easy and fine, that just getting through stuff and just lasting longer is not the marker of a happy relationship.
Yeah.
For a long time now, we've been fans of AdamandEve.com for getting sex toys or lingerie or accessories, things like that. It's just a fantastic resource with a huge selection. And now, not only do we have a fantastic offer, but we also have a promo code that will work on adammail.com and evestoys.com, which are their sites specifically for LGBTQ audiences. And our code is fantastic. It's 50% off of almost any item in the store and free discreet shipping when you use our code MULTI.
Yes, we love AdamandEve.com and have for years. They are our oldest and longest sponsor, and they just keep on giving great gifts to us and to our listeners. You can bring more pleasure and satisfaction into your bedroom by going to AdamandEve.com, AdamMail.com, or EvesToys.com and select any one item. It can be, you know, an adventurous new toy or anything you desire, something fun, something sexy, whatever sounds good.
So just enter offer code MULTI at checkout and you'll get 50% off almost any item plus free shipping. That's MULTI, MULTI at adamandeve.com, adammail.com, or evestoys.com. This is an exclusive offer that is specific to this podcast and it's better than any offer that is currently available on their site. So again, use code MULTI to get you not just the 50% discount, but also the 100% free shipping. Code MULTI.
So what are the things that are really specific to non-monogamy when we're talking about all of these like hangovers that occur or whatever? What do we want to call it now?
The ghosts of normativity past.
Sorry, the normativity.
The normativity ghosts.
The normativity ghosts. How do they...
Echoes of normativity.
Oh.
That's going to be my album name someday. God. Echoes of normativity.
People would be like... What is he? Okay.
No, because it's going to be, you know, the crowd that it's for, they'll get it.
They'll get it? Okay. Yeah. Well, that's good. Yeah. Well, what are those normativity echoes that occur when you're specifically in a non-monogamous relationship?
Well, let's talk about the ghost of hierarchy
past.
The ghost of hierarchy past. It's not about hierarchy specifically. If y'all want to listen more in depth about our thoughts and feelings and philosophies about hierarchy, you can check out specifically the episode that we did on it, and I don't have the episode number, so you're going to have to go to multiamory.com and just type in hierarchy into our
search bar,
and you will find it.
Handy dandy.
Anyway, It's not just a hierarchy-specific thing. For me, it was very much this long lingering idea of, well, whatever happens, I need to be number one.
You're number one.
However that looks, whether that's being called primary or I'm the girlfriend and everyone else is a hookup or
whoa,
whatever else you wanted to call it. It was just like, I need to be number one, or and I need to feel number one, or I need to be the most special out of everybody.
Was that with everyone? Were you ever like in a position where you were like, I am fine being the hookup to this person or the secondary to this person?
Let me think.
Like, for a while, like, you had a primary, and Brad and Jason and I were primaries, kind of.
Yes, yeah. I'm thinking more further back. I was okay being someone's hookup, but if they had, like, a hardcore primary partner, I really didn't want to know about it and didn't want to get too involved. And definitely... Like,
don't ask, don't tell, lady?
I mean... It's blurry between like what was me specifically wanting don't ask, don't tell versus what was me dealing with the ghost of casual dating past and like casual dating behavior.
It's the assumption that which you is just the don't talk about.
Yeah, the assumption being you just don't talk about
it. I see.
It. So there was kind of that, I suppose.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But I feel like this one actually may be one of the most malignant ghosts that is really hard to get rid of, is this idea that, oh yeah, non-monogamy is all fine, and philosophically I get it, and it's all great, but I still want to be the best. I still want to be the most important person to this person.
I want to be the very best, like no one ever was.
Yeah.
Right, yes, yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
I guess that, and it's something that I feel like comes up a lot in stuff people mention in like the private patron group, or just in our own personal experiences, our personal lives, relationships with people, in our own hangups that have come up at times. Like, I feel like this is a big one, because that's with some of the stuff we were talking about in the first half of the episode, they all kind of come back a little bit to this idea of the one, or like that things are predestined, that there's kind of this sense of like, I guess the sort of this sense of magic around the relationship, this sort of like a mythology or like sort of a spiritual like faith about that relationship, that we're sold that. And in the world of like unhealthy monogamy, I'll say, there's kind of that you're trying to force that to fit, you're trying to force that to happen, or you're making assumptions about other people because of those beliefs or right for mostly for bad, but I was going to say for good or bad. And then in this, it's like, even in non-monogamy, you kind of let go of that, but there's still this hanging on idea of like, but in order to like actually be loved, I need to be the most special. That there's that. And that's a difficult one to let go of.
Or even the most special at something. Like I'm the best at giving you blowjobs. Out of all your partners, like even just that, like the word like best or special like comes into play. I think again, we're kind of in this competitive mindset. So many of us that like we still need to top someone else, even if that someone else is like the loving partner of our partner, loving metamour.
It's like thinking of it as a competition where like if I'm not the best, then they're gonna leave me.
Yeah,
because it's all a competition. It's all very much like, because
we're all kind of on this path of just upgrading our partner one after the other.
Right.
You know, the way we upgrade our technology.
Yeah.
And
get that new iPad.
Yeah, we just hop from new model to new model. And so it's like you have to try to maintain being, just the best and like the newest and the shiniest at all times, or else you're going to get left for someone else.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of people being left, there is that like idea and that fear that maybe someday you'll be left for someone who wants to be monogamous again.
Whew, I definitely have that fear because of how many times
it's happened.
Well, it has happened.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say to me it's happened like an excessive number of times, but it has happened for sure. And then I've also just witnessed, what? How do I want to describe this? I've definitely witnessed relative newbies to non-monogamy experience kind of their first NRE with a new partner and get caught up in all our mythology around NRE of like, oh, if you're feeling this way, that must mean you need to be with this person. Maybe they're actually the one, you know. Mm-hmm. I've even seen people who identify as polyamorous even start to toss out like, oh, maybe I'm with the wrong primary. Maybe this person I'm in an NRE with should be my actual primary, which is just kind of like the same mythology, but with different labels put onto it, you know?
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah.
And so I definitely have that fear, especially surrounding like anytime I date a partner who's relatively new to things of like, okay, this is all fine and good, but I've never met this person yet. Or like, I don't know this person and how they respond to NRE. And so I don't know if like, if NRE hits this person, if they're just going to be like, oh, well, see ya, you know? Mm-hmm. So I definitely have that fear. I have that less with partners where like, you know, I've been around them when they're in NRE with people and they've gotten through it and you know, they haven't decided to like, you know, up and leave everyone and be monogamous with this person.
Yeah.
I think this one lives in a similar place to me to that idea of like, the fear that, well, if you're not doing the normal things, like you're going to end up alone and sad someday. That there's kind of that where it'll even come up with relationships where I have no like reasonable reason to fear this. Like, for example, with my relationship with Dedeker, where it's just sort of this like, well, what if everyone, you know, what if everyone's right? That like eventually... it's a phase and eventually like she'll get over it.
She'll get over it.
Want to be monogamous.
Doesn't matter that she wrote this book and does this podcast with me.
Right.
She's going to get over it.
Right. It sounds absurd, but I like,
and I'm just going to want to find a man with a bigger wallet.
Yeah.
To settle down with.
Whatever it is. Right. All those, whatever it is.
It's not how I actually feel. I'm just tossing out all the weird toxic stories that like are out there.
Yeah.
But my point here is that that's an actual like real fear that I have felt.
Yeah.
Without that being rational. And that's, again, that's kind of what we're talking about here is these ghosts that come back to haunt you from these beliefs or this idea of just sort of like, what if the mainstream is right and I'm wrong?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, geez.
Another one that I think comes up for people is just straight up when they're first opening up is it's still like there's still this guilt because it still feels like cheating in some way, or even expressing to their partner being attracted to someone else, or even honestly telling their partner
playing it.
Yeah, exactly. Or feeling that urge to downplay liking someone else or wanting to go on a date with someone else or wanting to have sex with someone else because we feel like, oh dear, this is, you know, we've definitely been taught from day one, like, do not talk to your romantic partner about these things. It's it's hurtful to tell them these things in the first place.
You know,
just ignore it and forget it and don't talk about it. And then that can definitely keep people trapped. It definitely kept me trapped for a long time in really poor communication habits of just not getting, you know, really not talking about these things, not getting joy about talking about these things, assuming it's going to be hurtful to a partner. And so I need to either not talk about it or downplay it or talk around it or whatever.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And I think that it also can breed like expectations being kind of parsed apart in a way that like you sit there and say to your partner like, well, you know, I had sex, but it didn't feel, you know, like when we do, or it wasn't as good as it is with you or whatever. And then if they see you
downplay it.
Exactly. Yeah. And then if they see you like have NRE or be really excited about maybe going on a trip with that person, they're like, well, wait, like I thought that you didn't feel as good about them. And so I'm surprised that you're doing this, you know, important thing with them when I had this impression that you actually weren't that into them. So I think it can breed like things that are not, I don't know, just the poor communication and blindsiding someone to a degree just because of that poor communication.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
your family and friends and people you meet can dredge up all kinds of normative ghosts.
Uh-huh. We've talked about some already.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I think we covered a number of these things in one of our live show episodes from 2 years ago about being non-monogamous within a largely monogamous world. But, you know, of course, there's all the assumptions that come around, you know, like, you know, just so many people you meet are going to assume you are monogamous. They see you out with a partner. They're going to assume you are monogamous. You are on the relationship escalator. You are doing these things. And so it's kind of like the hangover or the ghosts or the echoes can be perpetuated by other people in your life, even if you yourself are not wanting to maintain that or not ascribe to that. You know, so it's everything like, you know, I've heard a lot of people talk about family members, even though I'm out to them, they still only ask about the well-being of one partner.
Yeah.
Or they still only ever invite this one particular partner. Or, you know, I don't know, all kinds of things like that.
Yeah. Well, what about a fluid bonding?
What about it?
Yeah, I mean, sure.
Well, like, just even the idea.
Sure.
Okay,
sure.
Sorry.
Yeah, okay.
This is not what I was expecting your response to. Fluid bonding, sure.
Sure.
No, but just the idea that, like, somebody is more important if you fluid bond with them, or that it, like, is almost like a relationship escalator-esque type thing. Like, it means you leveled up with them because you're fluid bonded with them.
Or it's a hierarchy kind of thing.
Totally. Yeah. Like,
I just want to get in front of y'all and just say,
get in front of us right now.
I think there's kind of a weird paradox here because fluid bonding, and for those of you who don't know what fluid bonding is, I don't like the term, first of all, but it refers to choosing to have unprotected sex or, you know, an exchange of fluids with a particular person or multiple particular people. That's
it's
what
like
people
the word
refer to
moist
as
moist.
It's fluid bonding.
Fluid
it just makes me think of chemistry.
It's a problematic term.
Okay,
we can talk about that
what
later.
What I wanted to
whole
to
other
get,
episode, Jace. Yeah. Whole other episode.
What I wanted to get in front of you on was the fact that fluid bonding or choosing to have unprotected sex with somebody, it is an intimate thing. I do think it is an intimate thing. Like, I don't want to discredit it as meaning nothing. But it doesn't necessarily mean that it means something. Does that make sense? Was that a Zen koan?
Yeah, I mean, you could.
That's great. I mean, I like to say that about sex too, just in general.
Okay.
Like,
yeah.
It is an intimate, meaningful thing, but it also doesn't necessarily mean
need
anything.
To be.
Yeah. I know. I definitely like made some poor decisions in relationships. You know, I've ascribed fluid. You know, I've kind of assigned fluid bonding to the relationship escalator. Like, I've definitely been in relationships where it's like, well, it's about that time that
we're feeling serious.
We're feeling maybe kind of serious, or I feel
so
like maybe I have some feels.
Are coming
so
off.
The condoms are coming off. You know, I've had people thank me to be like, wow, I'm really glad to know that you trust me. And this is also, by the way, making this decision purely emotionally, not actually talking about, hey, let's talk about sexual history and let's talk about sexual health, purely an emotional decision of, hey, we feel safe around each other, so let's have unprotected sex, which was not a wise decision and not anything I would recommend anybody do. But related to that, you know, then when I went on to non-monogamous relationships, I definitely ascribed this whole idea of, like, again, me needing to be number one and needing to be special of, like, well, I need to be the one that this person is having unprotected sex with, because if I'm not, and if this person is having unprotected sex with someone else, that means I'm not the most special, and we can't have that now, can we?
They all sort of interconnect with each other,
huh? Really
yeah,
they really do. They really do. I don't know. I feel like my party line and the party line on the show, and it's a party line that's not a party for anyone because it seems like everyone feels like it's a drag, but my party line is always about, like, choose to protect yourself first, you know, err on the side of safe sex, and maybe err on the side of, you know, maybe kind of maintaining safe sex principles across the board with all of your partners rather than making it different for different people. But people come from all kinds of different contexts and all kinds of different, like, health backgrounds and needs. And so I don't want to put that out there just as a total blanket statement, because I know we're going to get people who are going to protest that. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. But that's my personal philosophy is I try not to make the mistake of thinking that a piece of latex carries this huge meaning, like that a piece of latex,
or I was about to say snake skin.
Ew. Emily,
what is it, lamb skin?
Emily, Emily.
It's the new craze. It's the new craze, snake skin.
I don't think that that would do very much.
Emily, every single part of my genitals is horrified right now. And
like,
just like,
please continue.
I never want to have sex again.
I really didn't see that coming.
However, whoa. I can see it looking very fashionable at the same time.
Yeah.
That's like,
I'm
if you...
like, ooh, stylish, but ooh, don't bring that near me.
It's gonna be clothed in snake skin.
It's gonna be on all the nude beaches in,
from here to Timbuktu.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh boy.
Anyway, I feel like I talked a lot about fluid bonding. I'm sorry. So y'all can chime in.
Okay, please. Cheers.
Well, I was just gonna move on to the next one. Here is this idea of feeling morally inferior. Because that's what society's going to tell you, right? Is that you're somehow less morally upstanding than other people who are doing the normal thing.
All what are all those, like, different studies that people do where they're like, look at a monogamous person and a non-monogamous person?
Yes, we've presented on this.
Right, yeah, exactly. Like
what sort of stigmas, what beliefs do we have?
A non-monogamous person is less good at brushing their teeth.
Is the belief.
Not true.
Exactly.
I want to emphasize that's not true.
I'm kidding, but like that's what people like think automatically, that they're somehow like morally inferior, you said.
Well, the point of that study was that it's not even just people, the stigma means that people make assumptions about this person's morals, but it bleeds over into the rest of their life too. So they make assumptions. They make assumptions about like they're not as good at brushing their teeth, or they're less likely to walk the dog regularly.
Or flaws. Yeah.
Yes, or they're less likely to do their taxes on time or stuff like that.
And I do want to clarify about that particular study, because it does get trotted out from time to time, that these were not super significant differences, but just enough to show that there is a little bit of bias,
mm-hmm.
or like the halo effect is what it's called, kind of leaking over into how we feel about monogamous people versus non-monogamous people. But the other part of it that was interesting is that that same thing held true even for non-monogamous people themselves.
Yeah.
That they also had those
also internalized stigma.
Yeah. Mm. The stigma against ourselves, kind of.
Yeah.
And I think the flip side of this is that people can sometimes go to the opposite extreme of needing to really feel morally superior to everyone else, which is
like,
where...
I'm way more evolved than you are.
Right.
Oh,
exactly.
Definitely. I've pulled that one before.
Oh, for sure. Me too. It's like the classic polyamory newbie. Like that
Everyone goes to that phase.
It was like that new video by School of Life that was really annoying, where they kind of had some non-monogamous couples talking and everything.
Is that the one with Dedeker's book in it?
Yeah, the one where they clearly did not read my book.
They did not read her book, first of all.
They just waved it around.
And second of all, I was just listening to them. I was like, yeah, okay. This is a fairly accurate depiction of newbies to polyamory talking about it like it's this very evolved thing. Yeah, absolutely. And just being like, yes, I see that, but it sucks that this video just like ended after that and was like, see, clearly ridiculous. So anyway, just to say, like, don't, I know that comes from this place of being so scared of
like
being
needing
morally
to compensate
inferior.
For people seeing you as being inferior in some way. Well, that
so
makes sense.
I think a lot of people out there will blame any problems that you have with your relationship on non-monogamy. And you might also internally be like, shit, like, maybe my life is going to hell right now because I'm non-monogamous.
It's like that idea of like, well, it would all just be easier if
but right? Like, in reality, like, if relationships are bad and you're monogamous, like, no one's questioning monogamy,
right? It's so
usually
absurd.
Yeah.
I'm
assuming
for all the time someone's like, oh, well, I tried non-monogamy once and it was real bad. Or like, I had a friend who did and it was real bad. I was like, if we did the same for monogamy, like, oh, I had one of those and it was bad, so I'm never doing that again. No one would do it either.
Yeah.
Like, that's just a ridiculous way to...
No, I've thought about, like...
To judge,
Times that I've opened up about really bad relationships in my past, like abusive relationships, that happened to also be non-monogamous. And I've had experiences in sharing with people where they're not necessarily like, they don't jump right to, oh, it's because you were being non-monogamous, but they do jump to like kind of trying to use that as an explanation, in the sense of like, oh, well, like a man who acts like that is definitely not okay with non-monogamy, you know, or like, it's probably not someone who's going to be. So that's why things all fell apart, is because,
and you're like,
you know, that person, I'm having a hard time explaining it, but it's just when I think about the opposite of like, if I talked about, yeah, this person is really shitty and abusive to me. And someone is like, well, you know, you were in a monogamous relationship and, you know, you did have to really pitch him on this. Yeah, I don't know. Like it just, we don't hear it. And it's just so ridiculous. And but it's, but again,
it's
just like
otherness
the,
though, again,
like the stigma thing, it can be internalized as well, you know, like that. Like I've seen a lot of people that I know, like clients that I've worked with who do feel like, gosh, maybe if I'm just monogamous, it'll all be simpler. And to be fair, I do think with some people, they are making an accurate assessment. Like, like, you know, I definitely don't want to discredit people realizing like, oh, maybe the choice for me is monogamy. I think that's actually great. But I've definitely also seen people kind of just fall back on that of, you know, when there's deeper issues, just kind of assuming like, well, if we close our relationship or if I choose to be monogamous, then none of these issues will come up again, which is often not true.
Well, and also to go along with that, like if you have been dating around for a while and you're not monogamous and it's been really difficult to find someone that you really like, and then all of a sudden you do find someone, but they're all not really all in with the non-monogamy thing, then it can probably be really tempting to be like, well, shit, maybe I, you know, I found someone, maybe I should just go back to being monogamous because it is easier and because that's what they want. Like
kind of similar idea, right? Of like, well, maybe it would just be simpler if
I just like
or
adhered.
Oh, or even to go back to the one. Like, well, it's meant to be, maybe.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
You know, fate made me meet this person.
It brought us together.
And let me tell you, like, okay, the last crack I ever took at monogamy, the way, you know, I was at this place in my life where it's like I've been doing all the reading and I'd already, you know, dated around quite a bit trying to pitch people on this non-monogamy thing and it hadn't worked out, but I was still felt so convicted. I was still like, I still feel like this is something I want to try. I want to try to figure it out. I want to try to actually do it. And so when I met this person that I felt like super in love with, but he was definitely monogamous, you know, I would try to have these conversations with him and kind of try to pitch it to him. And the way he would always frame it to me was like, how can it be so hard to just be with me? Like, what are you afraid of? Yes, that it was a challenge. Like he posed it as like, this is the easiest thing ever. You know, like,
I
know you can do, like, of course you can do this. It's like, it's not that difficult to commit or whatever. And that totally,
but almost like he was telling you, you were taking like the easy way out of like, what do you think, this is too hard for you?
Oh, cause I didn't read it.
Okay.
Well,
do you know what I mean? Cause it seems like, is it really so hard to do this? Makes it seem to me like, oh, well, you're just not doing monogamy because you don't have like the chutzpah for it.
Yeah.
Not,
I guess it was kind of like that, or just like kind of assuming it's,
aren't
like,
I enough?
Like, there was definitely, I don't know, there was all kinds of stuff wrapped up in it. But I feel like I remember the moment very clearly because I remember it hitting me and it producing this sense of like, well, yeah, I can do that. Like, that's not too hard for me. Like, of course I can do that when you put it that way.
Yeah.
You know, don't try to imply that I can't do something.
Right.
And so, yeah, I took the bait and...
that didn't work out so well.
Didn't work out so well, but... You know, I can be thankful that it did help me realize that.
Yeah.
That's, you know, that again, just helped me realize, okay, no, truly monogamy is not really the thing for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's like a lot of different ways that these sort of ghosts can show up. And you know, as you could tell by when we're talking about this, that it's like, oh, yeah, and this one's connected to this other thing. And like, oh, yeah, there's this. It's like, it's because it's all like this big knotted together ball of different threads, right? Of different beliefs or different ideas we've been taught or different things we've been told we should do or we should want, and maybe that we have wanted at different times, that they're so intertwined with each other. I think that's why these ghosts can linger like that, because it's not just one thing. It's not like, oh, I changed my belief about this one thing and now I think differently.
Yes.
It's like, no, there's all this other stuff tied together with it that you're trying to pull out that one, and it can take a while for everything to get untangled, you know?
Yes, definitely, definitely. So we wanted to also present you with some possible solutions, or as I like to call them, counterspells, as they're referred to in the Relationship Anarchist Manifesto.
Oh yeah, that's where that's from. I was like,
yes.
Did you coin that term in your book, Missy?
No, I'm definitely not going to take credit for that. So even just starting from the place of understanding that this kind of hangover, dealing with these kind of ghosts that come up, totally normal, totally understandable. It's like we're the products of the culture that we're raised in. Yeah. We're the products of the messages that we're raised with. It's not necessarily like your fault and you're not a bad person for still having these feelings come up. So have a little bit of compassion, have a little bit of awareness, and just know that like it is okay. And it is okay to recognize them and have the awareness to be like, oh yeah, I know what that is. I can label that as like, that's, you know, this old soulmate mythology, or that's this old assumption that, you know, monogamy is morally superior, or whatever it is for you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Another one is community.
Mm.
Just like try, and we obviously talk about this a lot on the show because we have a huge, awesome community within our Patreon. People, all you Patreon people. And then also just like, I think the three of us have community within each other and within people who know all about what we're going through and what we've been through, and we're able to help them. But if you're able to just speak about things that are occurring in your life, things that like come up and that are challenging on a daily or weekly basis, and just like be able to have some empathy for yourself and for each other, I think it's a hugely helpful thing.
Yeah, going along with that, with community, is just outlets to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
Is just to be able to talk about it with people who go, oh yeah, I totally get that, I understand that, but it's gotten better, you know. People who actually who get it, which goes along with finding a community that you can talk to. And then the last one is role models and mentors, which again comes from that community of like having people who've been doing this longer than you and who have an understanding of these things, who can kind of help you to work through this.
I know for me, you know, because sometimes it can be hard to find specific role models or specific mentors who are going through the same thing that you are or trying the same thing that you are. For me, I still get a lot of inspiration from finding role models who are people who are still like bucking trends and bucking normativity and trying to forge their own path. Even if it's not necessarily like about, let's say, non-monogamy specifically or anything in particular. I just want to give a shout out because I follow on Instagram this model, Aiden. I think it's Aiden. Maybe it's Aiden. I don't know.
Aiden, hello.
Aiden Dowling, who was the very first trans man to ever be on the cover of Men's Health magazine.
Oh, that's awesome.
Right.
And he does these like really, really amazing posts and talks a lot about his past, even like posts a lot of, you know, pictures, you know, from his past, and kind of talks a lot about his growth. And even though I'm not personally on this journey of, exploring outside of like the gender that I was assigned at birth or anything like that, I still find it extremely encouraging and extremely hope producing of like, hey, there's someone out there who has this courage to kind of go against the mainstream and find what was right for them and find all this fulfillment and happiness in that. And so I can do that for myself too in this other arena. So it's also good to find role models or mentors who inspire you in that way. It doesn't have to be an exact mirror image of what you're going through.
Sweet.
Yeah. Anyway, and related to that, I would also love to hear what other people would recommend as far as, well, it doesn't have to be Instagram accounts, but people that they're inspired, people who are kind of going against the grain and forging their own path. I love hearing about that kind
of
stuff.
Great hearing about more people like that.
We need more for sure.
Definitely. We'd definitely love to hear. I mean, a lot of people have sounded off in the Patreon group about the specific ways that, you know, monogamy hangover has influenced their lives, but we'd definitely love to hear, what are your ghosts of normative past? What are the things that you're trying to exercise on a daily basis? The best place to share your thoughts and to share that with us and with other listeners is on this episode's discussion thread in our private Facebook group or Discord chat. You can get access to these groups and you can join our exclusive community by going to patreon.com/multiamory. In addition, you can share with us publicly on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. You can email us at info@multiamory.com. You can leave us a voicemail at 678-MULTI-05. Or you can leave us a voice message on Facebook. Multiamory is created and produced by Jace Lindgren, Emily Matlack, and me, Dedeker Winston. Our episodes are edited by Mauricio Balvanera. Our social media wizard is Will McMillan. Our production assistant is Nicole Samra. Our theme song is Forms I Know I Did by Josh and Anand from the Fractal Cave EP. The full transcript is available on this episode's page on multiamory.com.
Hey, this is Dan Savage from the Savage Lovecast and Savage Love. You're listening to a Swing Set podcast at Swing Set FM.